A very good evening to you. On behalf of the organizing committee of the annual Edward Said London Lecture, I would like to welcome you to tonight's talk and to thank Neil McGregor and the British Museum team, particularly Joanna Mackle, for hosting the lecture for the third year running. Many thanks also to London Review of Books and Mary Kay Wilmers. The lecture was established in 2009 by a small group of London-based friends of Edward Said, Professor Jacqueline Rose, Ahdaf Suaif, Mary Kay Wilmers, as well as Mariam Said and myself representing the Catan Foundation. Literary critic, writer, activist, spokesperson for the Palestinian cause, Edward was one of the most influential intellectuals of his time. The lecture series aims to expand and to promote his spirit through the continued examination of the links between culture and politics in the Middle East and elsewhere. The title, the Edward W. Said London Lecture rather than Memorial Lecture, is also designed to emphasize the forward-looking nature of Said's work and of this particular lecture series. In order to expand his profile beyond academia and the intellectual life of the UK, London in particular. In 2010, Marina Warner gave the first lecture with a wonderfully original reading of the Arabian Nights. And last year, Professor Rashid Khalidi spoke forcefully about the destruction of some important parts of Jerusalem's heritage in the name of a museum of tolerance. Future speakers, we hope, will include Noam Chomsky, Naomi Klein, Daniel Barenboim, but also younger voices emerging from the region and elsewhere that demonstrates the high standard of intellectual rigor, analytical force, and originality set by Edward Said, and that can help us interpret the complex ways in which culture and politics interact. I hope you'll agree with me that tonight's speaker fits this rather demanding bill to perfection. I now leave the stage to Professor Jacqueline Rose to introduce Ahdaf Suaif. Thank you very much for coming.
Good evening, everybody. Let me start by welcoming Mariam Said. It's a great honor to have you here with us this evening. To say that Ahdaf Suaif has been for many of us in Britain the voice of the Egyptian revolution is in a way to state the obvious. I know that I am one of many for whom her dispatches from Tahrir Square last year became one of the most important ways to feel, not just informed, but connected to the extraordinary events that were unfolding before her eyes. I know too that while she conveyed so graphically the unbelievable nature of what was happening, its spontaneous, unprecedented political moment for the Egyptian people, what made her writing so powerful and convincing was that at the same time, Ahdaf Suaif did not seem surprised. She had been dreaming of this moment for a long time. "I had a vision of revolution," she said to a woman who approached her. "It happens in Tahrir, Liberation Square." I have been reading her remarkable book on Cairo, My City, My Revolution. She had been intending to write it, as I understand, for many years. But it was only possible to write it when her city and her people started enacting her dream. Ahdaf Suaif's courage does not just belong to her being there at such a dangerous time. I know that for her there was no question but to be there. But also to the way she does not hesitate to describe the pain, violence, and wounds of the revolution, its dangers and its always precarious future, while holding on to and communicating her unerring faith in, quote, "our peaceful, democratic, young, inclusive, open source, grassroots revolution." I, for one, am grateful to her for the way she knows how to conjure hope out of the dark. One moment sticks out for me when she's walking home one evening through a darkened, shuttered, and frightening city. "It's not a film anymore," she writes. "This is the reality that we've been living for decades, finally risen to the surface. At last, our capital reflects the true condition of the country and our lives, burned and broken and almost ruined, and now we'll have to save it." Like the revolution, she is a truth-sayer. I think that's why we feel so safe in her hands. Ada Swerf is renowned as one of the most eloquent and gifted Egyptian-born writers of her generation. I have had the great pleasure of reading her political commentaries for many years, in addition to her dispatches from Cairo this past year, her essays and articles, although they're more like interventions, gathered together in her acclaimed collection, Metsatera, Fragments from the Common Ground, published in 2004. Whether writing an open letter to Tony Blair, protesting his complicity in Sharon's reoccupation of key West Bank cities in 2002, or in her reading of what the veil means for women in Egypt, she always, as well as protesting against injustice, provides the local detail which brings a moment of political reckoning and judgment to life. The dissenting Israeli soldier, dismayed by what his country requires him to do to the Palestinians, or the veiled woman, this is one of my favorite moments, holding on to her dignity when she is almost mowed down by the speeding car of a leather-clad woman from the new Egyptian moneyed class made rich by Sadat's capitulation to the West. I think this is what also makes her such a fine novelist. As well as Aisha and the Sandpiper, In the Eye of the Sun of 1992 and The Map of Love of 1999 are international bestsellers, The Map of Love shortlisted for the Booker Prize. It would be wrong to say that the lines between her fiction and her political commentaries are seamless. I know she has to choose, and that the revolution has left her latest novel in suspense, but they are deeply connected. I am grateful to her for the ways she at once holds British history to account, but also shows how Britain and Egypt are profoundly linked in ways not yet settled by their histories. This is, as you all know, the Edward Said Lecture, and we are all very proud to have this lecture hosted by the British Museum, which of course also has much to say about the traffic between those two worlds. The beauty of having Adaf Swef deliver her lecture here was, however, only fully brought home to me when in her book on Cairo, she describes Tahrir Square, the Midan that feeds us, nourishes us as a museum. Quote, "This is the Egyptian museum that holds our ancestors, the museum that our Shabab defended, the museum that bears witness to who we are. If anyone can make us feel that this museum is connected to that one, it is Adaf Swef." We are honored to have her deliver this third Edward Said London lecture. She has kindly agreed to take questions after the lecture. Please join me in welcoming her.
Thank you very much, Jacqueline. I kind of feel that that was so fulsome that I would feel safer leaving it there rather than starting to put it to the test. I'm honored and privileged to be here. So thank you to the Edward Said Committee. Thank you to the British Museum. And of course, doubly honored that Maryam should be here tonight. And for me, of course, this is quite a confluence. The British Museum was one of my favorite places when I was here in London as a small child, when I was about 6 years old. Later on, I had political issues with it, as you may imagine, with the Egyptian collection, how it was acquired. And lately, I have, in fact, become completely reconciled to it and have become a fan once again, because under its present leadership, it has chosen to align itself with the world and to go back to being a resource and a place of discussion and debate, which is open to everybody. And I think that we've seen that. I've written about it with regard to the Nibamun Gallery, and we've seen it again in the various exhibitions that it has held. So it's with a completely clear and happy conscience that I'm here tonight. Edward Said was a great friend, as well as a mentor and an example. It's very few people that you can point to specific things, specific ways in which you conduct your life and say that comes from that person. And with Edward, I think many of us actually have that. And then, of course, the Egyptian Revolution. Well, what can I say? This is what largely I am going to be talking about. And talking about the museum and the collection is also, it's part of the point of this, because Mina Daniel, who is kind of the centerpiece of my talk here tonight, was a lover of Egyptian antiquity. He was fascinated by it. That was what he wanted to work in. He got a degree in Athar, and he was waiting, in fact, for his appointment to the Department of Antiquities. And we won't go into how the Department of Antiquities in Egypt has been conducted for the last long time. But anyway, Mina was still waiting when he died, when he was killed in October, in the events of Miss Piro. So Mina then, or rather Mina and his banner and the revolution and Edward. Actually, maybe I should start like this. Now, I guess that many of you, if not all, have actually read the little blurb that came with this talk, in which I say that it is not a lecture. In fact, it isn't. It doesn't have a beginning and a middle and an end. My head and my life at the moment don't really permit of such structures. And I say in it that this is a talk, it's impressions, it's fragments, it's feelings and ideas and beliefs. And that is truly what it is. So I want to tell you about the title of this presentation that you've so kindly come to hear. I think it was about 20 months ago that the steering committee and I agreed that I would be giving this year's talk. And then late last year, I was asked for the title. So imagine the context. I'm in Cairo, and there's everything happening. And then one night, there's the email that says, could we have a title for your talk on Edward, for your talk at the Edward Said lecture next May? And there was a bit of a delay. And of course, my first thing was, this isn't really a talk, this isn't really a lecture, this is a presentation, and so on. And then I found myself sending this, Mina's banner, Edward Said, and the Egyptian Revolution. And when I was asked to elucidate, I actually couldn't. I knew I had a title, I knew what it felt like, but I couldn't just write an email saying what I meant. But I hope that by the end of this presentation, it will be very clear what I mean. I tried my title out on my sons and on other young people in the revolution. I said, what do you think of this as a title for my talk? And they said, absolutely. So they knew what I meant, which, of course, made me a lot more confident about it. So let me share with you some of the experiences that to us make sense of tonight's title. And let me start by telling you just about Mina. And I'm sure that as I talk, you will yourselves be drawing the lines that connect him to the thought and life and positions of Edward Said. Mina was part of the revolution from the very beginning, from the 25th of January 2011. On the 28th, like many other young people, he was shot, but he survived. He got, we call it khartoush, and I don't know whether it's buckshot or what, but it's a bullet that fragments, and so you end up with sort of like 50 pellets lodged in you. And depending how far or how near the shooter was, you either just have some pellets which eventually work their way out, or you're dead. So he was shot from quite far, so he just had the pellets lodged in him. And then on the 9th of October, there was what became known as the Miss Piro massacre, which was basically that there was a big march that was scheduled to go from Shobra, which is a district of Cairo, heading into town. It was mainly a Christian march, although there were a lot of Muslim sympathizers with it. And it was in response to a string of events targeting churches that had happened, well, really not since the revolution, but since the year before, when the regime started, in fact, to try to play the card of hitting the fault line between Christian and Muslim and encourage and incite, in fact, sectarian violence. And in fact, the first time that MENA became politically active was in the middle of 2010, when in Upper Egypt, in Nega Hammadi, there was a shooting outside a church and seven people died. Eventually, it turned out that it was a member of parliament who had instigated this. And later on in the year, there was the event which you may know of, which was the Church of the Two Saints in Alexandria, where 21 worshippers were killed on New Year's Eve. And the government, of course, accused the Muslim Islamist current and arrested some people. And one young man, Sayyid Bilal, was tortured to death. And later on, during the revolution, in fact, a file was found which implicated the Ministry of the Interior in these events, which is what people had guessed all along, that it had been actually set up by the regime, and the aim was always to turn people against each other. So, after several similar but less grave events, there was this march scheduled to go from Shobra into town, and it was about 5,000 people, and Mina Daniel was in it as an activist. Now, Mina had already very clearly put himself beyond sectarian, and if we have time, I will show you a tiny video where his discourse, since he became politically active, had been that the issue that interests him is not a sectarian issue, that he had the breadth to see that the issues were general, that it was that we had political problems with a regime that was running the country in a certain way, and that common cause had to be made by all of us to speak for the disenfranchised, the marginal, the poor, to speak against corruption, and that sectarian issues had no part in this discourse whatsoever. But he was part of that march, as I said, indeed were other people, and among them Muslim. And when the march arrived at Maspero, and Maspero is the name that we call the radio state and television, the state radio and television building on the riverbank, on the Nile bank, because that bit of road was called Maspero after Gaston Maspero, the Egyptologist. And so this building has become known as Maspero. So the march arrives there, and basically the army open fire. What they said, of course, was that a bullet had come from the march into the army, and the army had panicked and started to shoot. The army shot people and also ran over them with armored truck APCs, armored personnel carriers. And we have several good films that our young film artists and collectives put together very, very quickly, and which have been used, are being used, in fact, in the court case to show what happened. Mina was not run over by an APC. He was shot in the first minute of the attack, and he was shot by a direct bullet to the head. And this is the way, in fact, that several of the best or the most prominent and effective of our young activists have been killed since the revolution. He came from Asyut, that is from Upper Egypt, from a family that had to work hard to survive, and a family whose four children were had managed to get into higher education, but the family was still in Asyut. So this issue of marginality and of disenfranchisement was very, very clear in his life. Somebody who was waiting for 5 years for a job that was his, that he had more or less been appointed to but could not take. But what he did was that he turned from this personal set of circumstances a general cause and also an opportunity, a challenge and an opportunity to work to make things better for other people, not just for himself. He showed a remarkable ability to generate optimism. His smile was very, very well known in Tahrir. People who learned of the death of Mina Daniel, a lot of them didn't know that that was Mina Daniel until they saw his picture and recognized his smile. He was a very active presence. He was able to gather people. He was cohesive. He was friendly. He had a sense of fun. So, therefore, these were the qualities of leadership that that we needed enormously, but that, in fact, the regime has targeted anybody who displayed these qualities since decades, and no less so now. Challenged authorities spoke out on the side of the oppressed and turned a personal issue into an ethical challenge. And I just want to show you a couple of pictures just to make things come alive a little bit. So here is Mina. Now, this is the 28th of January when he had the pellets embedded in his leg, and they're now being taken out, and he's just grabbing a friend's hand for support against the pain. This is an activist picture. And how many people here don't speak Arabic? Okay, lots. I'll translate. Okay, so the banner says, "Where are my rights?" Fin hu'i. And this is, actually, I would like to show you a tiny little, if I can find it. Okay. Here it is. Now, this is a skit on a very popular 50s song, which says, "ليه الدنيا جميلة وحلوة وانت معايا." Why is the world so nice and lovely when you're with me? So he and his friend, they make it, "Why is the revolution so nice and lovely when you're with me?" And of course, his friend is a Muslim, and so on. This was just
ثورة جميلة وحلوة وانت معايا ويضاف إلى ذلك هيناهم هيناهم هنشنوهم هيناهم دي تمارين الصباح إن شاء الله هيناهم هيناهم
And there's always somebody in the background saying, "Why are you doing this? And perhaps you shouldn't be filming." And so on. Never mind. We live with that. Okay. And then here is Mina after they killed him. And sister. Now. Okay, and this is his coffin, and the young man with the long hair there is my nephew, whom you may have heard of, Ala Abdel Fattah, the activist who was then jailed, and behind him is another friend. And the interesting thing about this as well is that this is the first time for a very, very long time that you could have Muslim boys carrying a Christian coffin. Mina's death did something in that immediately people came out. I mean, someone like my nephew, for example, Ale, he was at home, and he heard that there had been shooting in Maspero, and so he rushed out and got to Maspero, and it was over by then, and he was looking for Mina, and so he was told that people had been taken to the Coptic hospital. So he went to the Coptic hospital, and there were thousands of people, because the Copts, the Christians, people were coming to look for their children, were coming to look for their relatives, but also people were coming for safety because they felt tremendously threatened. And so they were heading for a place that they knew that there would be large numbers and that they felt that they would be safe. So Ali and three of his friends arrive, and of course they're Muslim, and they arrive in this, and they shoulder their way in, and they go into, they're asking for Mina, and they're asking for somebody else, the fiancé of a young woman, and eventually they go into the morgue, and they are there. So they go into the morgue, and there are 17 bodies on the floor of the morgue. And what is happening is that the hospital, as all hospitals were doing at that point, is starting to issue death certificates that cite death from natural causes. So the heart stopped, or the circulation stopped, or whatever. Death from natural causes. And also, and of course, the families are beside themselves with grief, and they're mostly poor families, disadvantaged families. And the priests are there saying, hurry up, you need to bury your child. And if you hurry up the procedures, Abuna, the priest, our father, is waiting to bless them in the church. But you need to hurry so that he's still there. And so basically everybody, the authorities, are all pushing the people to accept the death certificates. And when anybody says anything, they're told, there's no justice for the poor here. Justice is with God. Hurry up and get your child prayed over before they're buried. What Ali and his friends do is they take this all on. And they barricade themselves. They barricade themselves into the morgue. The morgue only has four drawers in the fridge. And there are 17 bodies. They start sending out calls for fans and for ice. This situation lasts for 2 days, where they're keeping the bodies of their friends fresh. And they are talking to the people. They're going out, they're talking to the families, they're hugging them, they're crying with them, and they're telling them that it is essential that they have autopsies. Meanwhile, a group is at the public prosecutor's office. Eventually, and one of them is, one of the group at the public prosecutor's office is Khaled Ali, the young candidate who is not going to win the presidency this time round, but God willing, next time. And they more or less force the prosecutor to issue an order that that the bodies should have autopsies. And the prosecutor starts by saying no, and then starts by saying, well, if I issue for one, I'll have to issue for everybody, so you've got to get everybody to agree. Anyway, they get the order. And meanwhile, another group is at the coroner's office. Now, remember that these are all officials of the state, and they all want this thing covered over and finished. So another group is at the coroner's office, and they more or less carry the coroner bodily out and make the coroner and his team come to the Coptic hospital, and meanwhile bring a team of doctors who are trusted because they are activists. Mina, Mona Mina, who instituted Physicians Without Rights, she comes in, and the autopsies are carried out by the official coroner in the presence of the activist doctors who are trusted. And then the coroners, by then the coroners have actually become semi-human, and by the end of it they become completely human, and they sit with the families and explain to them what the reports mean and what they have to do next, and so on. So they ended up, the other thing that happened is that Mina Danielle's sister, Mary, who had so far not been political at all, steps forward. She steps forward and she takes the side of the young activists, and she actually eases their communication with the Christian families and says, these are Mina's friends. These are Mina's friends. They are his family. He belongs to them. You have to listen to them. And so out of this event, which was actually meant to totally blow open a fault line between Christian and Muslim, you actually got greater cohesion. Now, we know, because now various things have come out in the court case, even though it has taken a very long time and even though it's not completed, and because of the research that the young activists have done and have put on film, we know that it was orchestrated because, for example, state television, which was on top, I mean, this was happening just in front of the television building, and state television started immediately a prepared script. This is the main channels telling people that Christians were attacking the Egyptian army. Come down and protect your army. Come down and protect your army. Fortunately, nobody did because nobody believes or trusts state television. But that was the idea. And instead of it happening, what actually happened was that the communities came together at this moment of extreme grief and extreme stress. And out of that was also born Harakat Mina Daniel, the Mina Daniel movement, which is completely non-sectarian and carries forward his ideas. And Mary Daniel came to the front of the revolutionary activities and again became a figurehead. And instead of just having Khaled Said's mother, if you remember Khaled Said, the young Alexandrian who was killed several months before the revolution and whose page, We Are All Khaled Said, was the engine of the protests on the 25th of January. So now we had the mother of Khaled Said and the mother of Mina Daniel, and they became very symbolic, these two mothers in black of young men, one Christian and one Muslim, and both of them basically saying in every gathering where they came, telling the young people that you are all my children, and as long as you don't let go of your rights, and as long as you don't let go of the revolution, I believe that my son's blood has not been shed in vain. So they are tremendously powerful figures that we now have. So I think obviously what happened there was that people, one of Edward's sentences to bring to light the job of the intellectual to bring to light truths that powerful forces either obscure, suppress, or distort, and that is what happened at the Coptic Hospital. That is what continues to happen. Also, of course, the determinedly non-sectarian, broadening, inclusive stands. Now, shortly after the events of Maspero, we had the events of Sharia Muhammad Mahmoud. That was the next time that the military targeted and attacked the young people of the revolution. So this was on Friday, November the 18th, we had a massive rally, a millionaire in Tahrir, which was basically demanding that the military sort of sign in blood that they were going to hand over power in April. Some of the injured had set up tents in Tahrir and were staging a sit-in. And when the rally on the Friday ended, they remained. And next day, the military went in and started to remove them by force. And it went in heavily with armored personnel carriers and so on. And it was shooting. And then it withdrew and came back again. And anyway, until the 26th of November, actually, there was an ongoing battle in Muhammad Mahmoud Street. By the end of it, we had 42 dead. Other cities, of course, had also risen, and also a lot of people had come down in support and in solidarity. So across the country, by the end of that week, 42 were dead and 3,800 were seriously wounded. This was the first time that the military shot directly into the eyes, and so the activists who lost eyes, as in Ahmed Harara, Malik Mustafa, and others, it was on this occasion. And also, the military built the first wall that they built in downtown. Now, they had built one wall before, and that was in an attempt to protect the Israeli embassy. And everybody had wondered at their lack of imagination in not seeing that a great big grey concrete wall was not really the best thing to put up in Cairo. And in fact, activists had within days dismantled it. But in that had been in May, but in November, in Mohammed Mahmoud, they built the first of a series of six walls that blocked off various bits of downtown and that made the Israeli kind of visual analogy, you know, impossible really to mistake. We had the walls, we had the barbed wire, we had the military personnel who no longer looked like the old army that we knew, but were sort of, you know, in the shades and the sort of heavy stuff and so on, and shooting at people's eyes. And it was in Mohammed Mahmoud, if I can now find. Now, it was in Mohammed Mahmoud that this banner first appeared. And this is Mina's banner. And it was created by two of his friends. And you can see, I'm sorry, I mean, technically I'm not great. This should be a whole screen and resolution and so on, but this is what I've managed. So basically, this is the Egyptian flag, but it has, on the left there, you can see the crescent, which is Islam, and the cross, which is Christianity. And it has the words Hurriya. And on the red banner, on the red flag beneath the main flag, there is a picture of Mina. You'll see it better in other images. And there is the writing. The writing says, Kullina Mina Daniel. We are all Mina Daniel. And basically, from that point on, wherever there is confrontation with the authorities, wherever there is trouble, wherever there is shooting, wherever there are protests, Mina's banner is seen to fly. So here, so here's one. This one was outside, in a protest outside Maspero. This is daytime outside Maspero. You can see it a little bit clearer. This is in Mansour Street. This was the protests outside the Ministry of the Interior, in which, again, many, many people got shot. And basically, by then, Mina's banner is very clearly situated in that sort of conjunction of reality and mythology. It is there, we know it, we see it. By now we actually know the young men who have invented it and the young men who keep it flying. Nobody ever sees that banner lowered, and nobody ever sees it still. It is always waving, and it is always up ahead. And in Mansour, for example, in Mansour Street, outside the Ministry of the Interior, I was there as three young men, one after the other, tried to get in to where the banner was to relieve the flag bearer. And each one of them collapsed and had to come back choking. And the flag bearer did not waver and did not drop the banner and did not stop waving it. And it was the fourth one who managed to relieve him and send him back. The boy who carried the flag in there, in Shera Mansour, was not wearing a gas mask. We were all wearing great big gas masks. He wasn't wearing a gas mask. And he came out and his eyes were not even streaming. And he said that he had been shot at. Now, there were various people who were shot in Mansour, and you know, one knows them. Basically, the officers were actually just wandering out and wandering into adjacent streets and shooting people at will. This young man said that the officer shot him. He had a soldier shielding him, shielding the officer, and from behind the soldier he shot him twice from a distance of about 15 meters, and he didn't hit him. And he said that he felt the fear in the officer as the officer turned away. So, what is it that happens? What is it that happens to turn something into a symbol like that, to turn something into something that is invincible? And when I was talking about this title and about this talk again with people, with my sons, and they said, well, you know, you could say that reading Edward Said in an armchair or listening to him in a lecture, you got the same feeling that you got when you see Mina's banner waving up ahead of you. What this means is that you feel that you belong to a community that embraces a certain idea, a certain belief in your responsibilities as a human being, a belief in a way of life. You all know the oppositional, the speaking truth to power, and at the same time the humanity and the inclusiveness. And there was a brilliant sentence which I just found actually recently, which Edward says in a talk with Jacqueline, actually, published in the LRB, I think 97, 98, where he talks about the need to get away from issues of identity, where this whole issue of identity, he says, is frankly a colossal bore, and I think it's right off the mark. And what we should be doing is we should be moving away from that into what, I don't know, but away from these issues and into something broader and something that brings us more in touch with others. The date that I sent my reply to the steering committee here saying that this is my title was the 28th of November. And that, of course, I didn't even realize this, and I checked it yesterday and I found that it was the 28th of November, which must have been just a couple of days after I saw the banner for the first time, and immediately I knew what it meant. And what it meant was that this is our flag. And this is the flag that we rally around. And we fight for the space under this flag in whatever way we are called upon to do so. The revolution was determinedly peaceable. And it had violence forced upon it again and again and again. In the last round in Abbasiyah, which was like 2 weeks ago, the revolutionaries fought back. And again, Alec, my nephew, became very unpopular when he tweeted that some of the revolutionaries had weapons. But it was true. And it is something that we must take account of. But also we must take account of the fact that it has taken, 16 months and about 15,000 deaths and 10,000 injured and 20,000 subject to military trials before anybody from the side of the revolution picked up a weapon. The physical manifestation or physical symbolism of ideas or positions is very hard to come by. In a sense, the revolution itself was a manifestation of ideas and the symbol of ideas, of which probably the proponent that we know and love best is Edward Said. And this is roughly what I was talking about when I gave, again, the Edward Said lecture in Colombia last March. We are now in a different space, and the revolution no longer has that physical presence. You can no longer go up to the 10th floor in a building and look down on it in Tahrir. It is there, it is alive, but it is far more dispersed and diffused, although it continues very, very much to be alive and to be working and moving forward, but it's no longer there in that same way as a spectacle. And perhaps because of that, we have needed something else. And Mina's banner has come in to fill that void. Because it is really necessary. When you are confronted with a scene like that scene in Mansour or in Muhammad Mahmoud, when your friends are there, and there's really, basically, you're just under attack. It is scary. And seeing a physical object, seeing a banner out there, and a banner that actually symbolizes something that you believe in and that you treasure, it's indispensable. Edward's thought was very much in the revolution, and I think that some of you may have seen articles which were written after, particularly the day of the camel, when the regime sent in the horses and the camels to do battle with us in Tahrir Square. And basically, our feeling was one of outrage, that this revolution, which was so modern and so forward-looking, should kind of be orientalized by sending in horses and camels in that way. This was just one of the many times where Edward's thought came up. But a lot of the time, it was also simply wishing that he was there, because we were doing what I guess he'd waited for us to do for a very long time. That finally, we were shaking off post-colonialism. We were acting to take charge of our space, our country, our future, the way we wanted to do things, and we were doing it in a way that was peaceful, humorous, inclusive, modern, and so on. And very, very many of us would just have loved for him to be there and to see it and to be part of it, and we would have loved to be able to hear and read what he had to say about it. Because ultimately, our sense is that Edward's project was a project for dignity, for the dignity of our part of the world, and that is what he started by standing up for, and that is really, I think, maybe the all-encompassing concept for what he meant for us as he became our voice in the world. And this banner is also about dignity. And it's about standing your ground. It's about refusing to be used, whether for sectarian purposes, violence purposes, whatever. It is about knowing who you are, standing your ground, and fighting for your space. And another thing, I just actually wanted to mention, because I'm sure we're running out of time, but I want to mention two things that have happened through Mina and his death and what has come after it. Now, Mina became the first young murdered person, the first shaheed, to be recognized in stencil after Khaled Said. Khaled Said's stencils were everywhere. We lost a lot of people on the 28th of January and onwards, but it was when Mina was killed that his stencil appeared, and the whole that kind of portraiture of the people killed in the revolution became a tradition. So here, again, very quickly, the full length, and there weren't many who got the full length. And this was actually in Maspero, in the place where they killed him. And it's added to later by here, هنا قتل هذا البطل, this is where this hero was killed. So it grows. Again, we start to actually see different graffiti has been very, very important. And it was with Mina that it started to develop into what I would say is an art form. So here, this iconic picture, and here with other things starting to be drawn alongside it. And this was always, again, the picture that you just saw with Mina standing up, a full-length picture. He was later joined by full lengths of Khaled Said and of other young people who were killed with their arms around each other's shoulders. So graffiti, really, and here, with the lotus. And then in the event of November was Muhammad Mahmoud, December was the events around the cabinet office. That's again where more people were killed and where you will be familiar with the picture of the young woman in the blue bra being dragged through the street. In the events around the cabinet office, one of the people who was killed was a very popular man, an older man, 40, Ahmed Ifat, and he was a sheikh, he was an Azhari sheikh. He was actually the sort of head researcher of the office of the Sheikh of Al-Azhar, the Grand Imam of Al-Azhar. So he was a very academic, he was very much part of the revolution. And he also was targeted and shot, and in fact the young doctor who rushed to help him was shot on the spot as well. And the stencil that came up straight away, we will gain victory for your sakes. And that is Sheikh Ahmed on one side and Mina on the other. And at the same time, we got this. And that's Mina as an angel. And here you can see clearly. And there's something about, I think, now obviously I could be completely wrong, and obviously researchers and historians and so on will do something with this, but it is possible that something about the fact that Mina was Christian liberated that possibility of this sort of Byzantine iconography with the wings and so on. So we get Mina as an angel, and then very soon after, this is Sheikh Ahmed in freehand, and then there you go. Sheikh Ahmed in freehand with the Christian iconography of the angel's wings and with a phrase, with a verse from the Quran on his right. And that here it is in bigger, and the verse from the Quran that they choose is, and they said, Lord, we have obeyed our masters and our elders, and they have made us lose our way. Just to go back to Mina's banner for a minute, and what it, I mentioned Khalid Saeed, the young Alexandrian whose Facebook page helped everything along on the 25th. Now here's a young man carrying Mina's banner and wearing the mask of Khalid Saeed. So constantly people are mixing, coalescing. And this is Mary Danielle. I want you to just see her. This is Mina's sister. And you see her carrying the banner. And this is on the first day that Parliament sat. And we had all gone and marched to Parliament and were prevented from reaching it, because our message to Parliament was, you should take power from the military. Parliament refused to do that. But she carries the banner and she moves in.
دم اللي ضربته بالرصاص اللي ضربته عند مكبره بالرصاص اسمه منى دانيال ابيه.
So you don't see them, but of course facing her is the whole battalion of military. And what the young man is saying, he's saying to the military, this is the boy that you killed, this is the boy that you shot. Now, I said that in Muhammad Mahmoud, one of the things that happened was that the first wall was erected, and the wall eventually was taken down. But again, here, oops, I'm sorry. There's just to see, again, the banner. And by now, the banner has multiplied. So now you can get two banners in one place. And the banner is also seen in Luxor, in Mansoura, in Alexandria, all over the country. You see Mina's banner, and sometimes, as here, you've got more than one. I want to close with I have two endings, and I'm not sure which one I should, which one I should use. There's a clip here which I had actually prepared and sort of made pause. I don't know if it's still there or if it's gone away. It's gone. Okay, well, let's forget that then. That makes things easier. No, it's okay, because then we'd have to. Okay, fine. So basically, it was a clip of very early on with Mina in a television interview, and he's very scrubbed, and his hair is sort of brushed back. And this was in the early days of the revolution, before the older people had got their heads around the fact that these young people actually had something to say that was far more interesting than anything that they might have to say. And so he is faced by three older men who are patronizing him and sort of saying, why did you come out? And so on. Eventually, I mean, he starts off by, no, I'm not political, but yes, I came out because I'm interested. And then he talks about the fact that he's been waiting 5 years for a job. And then they push. And then he kind of pulls back. And he says, for justice. I came out for justice. You should go to, and starts enumerating districts of Cairo, and says, you should go there, and then you will know about justice. And again, this reminded me, the last summer that I saw Edward, the summer that he spoke in Brighton and in Hay-on-Wye, and he wasn't well, but he was still doing things. And what I noticed particularly was that people were coming up to him, not necessarily to say anything. People just wanted to be close. People wanted to be near him, to be in his presence. And actually, they wanted to touch him, but he wasn't very happy about that because he wasn't well, and there was the issue of germs and so on. But there was very much this sense of a talisman. And in Hay, he had one event, and then I had an event after that, and he very sweetly stayed for mine. And I was kind of being shredded a bit by David Aronovich and Christopher Hitchens, may he rest in peace. And in question time, Edward suddenly just erupted in exasperation. He said, why is it all about expediency? Why does nobody talk about the real things anymore? Why does nobody talk about justice? Why do I not hear the word justice? And that has just very much stayed with me. And so when Mina pulled himself up, all sort of spruced up in that meeting, and confronted those three sort of besuited, tied guys and said justice, and they kind of just didn't know what to say, really. Okay, I want to tell you two things. One is that art, that graffiti, kind of developed into the most amazing murals. And what is interesting is that although the graffiti is happening everywhere, but in Muhammad Mahmoud, it is taking on extraordinary dimensions and significance. I don't actually even know if I managed to get any of it with me, because I forgot my actual computer. But if you ever have a chance, there is a book that's going to come out, not mine. Here's one, actually. Actually, yes, here are two. And Richard, you particularly are going to... No, here, okay. So these are obviously, these are the young people from the ultras, the football fans who were killed, the Port Said event. And there is, I mean, there's just a whole street of them. These were 72 young people. But there with that, the energy and the... Uh-huh. Okay. And here. Our friends who lost their eyes. And here. Imagine a whole street. Oh, I'm sorry, I just did this one. Yeah. And the walls, the six walls that they built downtown, there's one of them. Okay? Every one of them. Now, so this here is a very kind of basic graffiti. You can see, of course, Mubarak on one side, Tantawi on the other. Up at the top, it says, "The revolution continues." And then there's the hand holding the pen, and under it is Rabtat Fannani Thawra, the Association of Artists of the Revolution. And at the bottom, Illi Kallif Mamatch, which is, it's a take on a saying, Illi Kallif Mamatch, if you have children, you haven't died. If you've had a kid, you haven't died. But here it's, if you've handed over, you haven't died. Because, of course, Mubarak handed over to Tantawi. Now, yesterday people woke up in the morning, and this was happening. Everything was being erased. And when people approached, of course, the poor guys who were doing the erasing, they were like, we're ordered. And of course, it's the administration of the governor that is doing that. And they came up with two statements. One was that they were, that these drawings defaced the cultured face of Cairo. And the other one was that they were preparing the capital for the advent of the new president. So they were made to stop because people went and formed chains and so on. And of course, people said, we're going to start again straight away. And immediately we had images coming in of young people, men and women going down, with their sleeves rolled up. And Twitter was full of calls for buckets of paint and so on. And no, you've got to open it. You've got to. Don't tell me you can't. Oh, no. Richard. It's this one. She won't do it.
I don't think it's going to go.
Okay, well, what I'll tell you...
Okay.
Oh, my God, what... Talk about climactic endings, huh?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Yes, change it to anything.
Close.
No?
No.
No? Okay, well, I will just tell you, you'll have to take it on trust, I will just tell you that basically what you get there, what you get in the new one, is you get the same image, but behind it, you get Ahmed Shafiq, presidential candidate, and behind it, you get Amr Musa, presidential candidate. Okay, so it's just sort of added what is going on now. I think what I've tried to talk about is, and I know it's fragmented, but everything is very much still a project. Everything is very much something in progress with bits of ideas and bits of feelings. And I've tried to speak to you from that confluence of politics and culture and ideas and sadnesses and triumphs that we are experiencing in the Egyptian revolution now, and that we very often are aware of the role of Edward's thought in it and in the point that it has brought us to. I hope it's made some sense. And if this works, I will leave you with this extremely short film again, it's got the banner, and again, it's Mohammed Mahmoud. And it's one of my boys. The fireworks are our weapons, so we have fireworks and the army has bullets.
Thank you, Ahdab, so much. We have apparently 5 to 10 minutes. I hope I can push it for some questions. Anybody?
Thank you. And thank you for being here and for talking to us this evening. Where do you think...
Where are you? Could you raise a hand? Okay, thank you.
Here you go.
Thanks. Where do you think the election, which is in progress, will lead? And how is the military going to react to that, do you think? Will it continue to bang people on the head? Or will it... Because when all this began... And I was here about just over a year ago when you spoke about what was happening in Tahrir Square. And you said then that you thought that the army was with the revolution. And to an extent, that was obviously quite true because we saw that. We saw it on our screens. But then the generals obviously put a fist, and things have got pretty rough since another.
Right. Well, we were wrong. I mean, we were understandably wrong because we really didn't have much option. We had been unable, the revolution had been unable to put forward a body that was powerful enough to stand up to the army and say, actually, we are taking power. It's understandable because of the nature of the revolution, but that is the fact. So we really... didn't have an option, and so we decided that we would trust the army and perhaps implicate them within the revolution. It didn't work. So what's going to happen now? Well, the elections are a step. They are not really ultimately what the revolution was about, and in fact, some of the most... of the people who are the most at the heart of the revolution have boycotted them because they are under the aegis of the military and the military has lost its legitimacy since it started killing people. But, however, they're there and people have voted and they are going to produce a president. And what happens next is, I think, very, very much dependent on the results. Voting should be closing about now. They said they would extend it to 9 o'clock, which is about 10 minutes away in Cairo. In Egypt, and it really depends on who comes next. If it's somebody from the old regime, which was looking this afternoon like it was unlikely, then probably people will take to the streets again immediately. If it's somebody sort of from the revolution, then people will wait and see what's going to happen. The president is coming into a very difficult set of circumstances because we don't have a constitution. We don't even have agreement on the committee that will write the constitution. And because, and that is your point, the most important point is that there is total and deliberate lack of clarity on the position of the army. So, and there are, the army budget, is the military going to agree to have its budget as sort of part of the normal budget and overseen by civilians, even if it's a small National Security Council? Will the military relinquish or negotiate about its economic activities and its economic holdings? And will it insist on having a role written into the constitution as the Turkish military did 20 years ago, and they're just kind of getting out of that? That is going to be what is on the table. That's going to be what's being negotiated. Obviously, the character and, you know, where the president is coming from is going to be very important, and also the relationship between the president and parliament. Parliament has not been able to do anything. Parliament is largely Islamist, but has a very strong secular minority. So truly, it's a very open question until we know who it is who is stepping into that hot seat.
So when the revolution erupted about a year ago, it was very easy to define the goal of the revolution that united all the forces that participated in it. Now, a year on, with all kinds of forces from the military to the Muslim Brotherhood to the others, we were talking about, they're all talking about the revolution. They're still all using the same term. But what's the revolution now? Is there a definition for it anymore?
Okay, well, I see what you're saying. And of course, you have a point. But I think that one division is very, very clear. And that division is between the people who actually believe in and want the revolution with what it stood for when it happened on the 25th of January, and the people who are using the discourse of the revolution to camouflage a desire for everything to go back to how it was, i.e. the military and a couple of the candidates and the remnants of the old regime and so on, who are, you know, in the business of paying lip service. And so, yeah, you know, you're glorious. I mean, they even exhort us to be quiet in case we lose the gains of the revolution, whatever they are. And so basically for them, the revolution is something that has happened, that they can call glorious, that they can say was performed or executed by good young people, and now let's wrap it up and put it in the sideboard and let's sort of carry on with our lives. So that's a very clear division. But within the people who actually believe in and want the revolution and are part of the actual revolutionary process, it is also correct to say that you don't have as united a goal as when you wanted to get rid of the regime. Now, we said the regime, what we got rid of was Hosni Mubarak. He symbolized the regime, and so that was a common aim. Fine. We can still say that the common aims of the revolution are Aish Hurriya Adal Ektimaiya, bread, i.e., you know, a decent economic situation for the country, freedom, i.e., human rights for everybody, Adal Ektimaiya, social justice. The issue is going to be, of course, particularly with the last one, human rights probably, well, even that is probably going to be debatable. But certainly with social justice and with the economy, there will be a debate as to how do you deliver social justice. You can agree that everybody needs to have education and a decent standard of healthcare, but how do you provide it? You know, is it the state's job? Is it philanthropical? Is it this? Is it that? That is a debate which the country needs to have. And the country needs to get into a space where it can have that, either through writing the constitution or through the normal processes by which countries arrive at how they want to run their affairs. What can't happen is that this can't happen while the military are there. A, because they create a situation in which you can't actually have an economic renaissance while the military are, you know, in position. And also because they can go down and kill you, and indeed they do, at any point. And you also can't have it while there is a possibility of a civilian-military coalition, i.e. with the Brotherhood and the military, so that you have that kind of fascist military state. So we need to get out into a civilian space first and then determine how it is that the country will be run.
I think we have time for one more question.
And I'll try to be very brief, Jude. I can't give short answers, you know, it's just awful.
I wanted to ask you, in the face of the amazing and very moving story of that young man, the many young men, and his sister and the mothers, but we've heard so much about the role that women have played in the revolution across the region, and yet there is also an anxiety now, I think, about what role women will play going forward. And it's not clear to me, hearing all the candidates this morning, all of whom were no women candidates, whether you feel secure about what the role that women will have in building a democracy and being able to have a legitimate place where they'll experience justice too.
Yeah, thank you. Well, what we've seen during the revolution, of course, is women acting as citizens and being totally part of everything that's happening, and phenomena like harassment sort of fading away during the glorious 18 days and so on. And then we saw it all come back, legitimized by the military, who were conducting virginity tests and dragging people through the streets and so on. What has been interesting there, of course, is that these were not new tactics. These were the tactics of the old regime, and in fact of many politically repressive regimes who use sexual humiliation and abuse as tools against both men and women. But in this case, what happened was that women stood up and fought back. So we had the case of Samira Ibrahim, who took the military to court, and because of her, they have not conducted virginity tests since, because they were totally declared illegal and so on. And it was her courage. And it, you know, clearly it's not just in Egypt where women find it hard to stand up in court and describe things that have been done to them. But she did it, and she therefore pushed things forward. And also the case of the young woman who was dragged through the streets, and then the march of 3,000 women who went out in her support. So basically, the fight back is very, very important. Now, what has happened, of course, with Parliament falling to the Brotherhood and the Salafists, is that there is a possibility that they are going to concentrate, or that bits of them are going to concentrate on issues to do with women and with the personal law. And they're going to look to change or to roll back, really, the gains that women have made over the last 20 years. They're using, I say they, which is not fair, because basically there have been two advocates of this in Parliament. One is a woman, sadly, Dr. Azza Garaf, which I'm sure many of you have seen her speech, in which she just completely wants to take away every every gain that was made by women, and sort of Mr. Al-Umda, who is also talking about two things, talking about reducing the age of marriage, so that making it possible for girls to marry younger, and reducing the age of custody. So that at the moment, I think the custody age, the mother has custody in a separation, the mother has automatic custody for boys until they're 12 and for girls until they're 15, and they want to take it back to something like 7 and 9. So that is very, very serious. Now, the sort of general excuse that they're using is that they are calling all the laws that were changed, they're calling them Suzanne Mubarak's laws. And so now we have to get rid of Suzanne Mubarak's laws because we're getting rid of the old regime. Of course, this is a complete con, because everything that happened in the country was dragged under the name of Suzanne Mubarak. Every library that was opened, every cookery school, everything became Suzanne Mubarak's And so that's why the laws were known as that, not because she had anything to do with them. And the other very sad thing about this, from a technical point of view, is that the laws that we have now represent a very long and serious and painstaking and creative effort by the judiciary and legal scholars to change the law to a better situation for women while keeping the framework of Sharia law. Because everybody knows that the country does not want to throw Sharia law out of the window, that you want to operate within it. And so these were really creative and clever ways of remaining in personal law within the boundaries of Sharia law, but using interpretation to make them more and more favorable to women. And so to throw all that out and go back to some unthought out, anachronistic form of legislation would be very sad indeed. All I can say is that people are tremendously aware of that and that people are going to fight it. And it's not just women who are going to fight it. I mean, I really believe that every decent man is a feminist. And we are all going to be in this together. And they're not going to roll it back without a major, major fight on their hands.
Thank you so much. Thank you.